It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up this hour, we'll ask you if you think women make better U.S. senators. Our guest says today's female senators are ready to do what their male counterparts can't, and that's get things done.
But first, we'll talk to a reporter who's part of a project on the unsolved murders in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism teamed up with Gannett Newspapers for a series of reports on the state's cold cases.
The team created the first ever database of all the unsolved murders here in Wisconsin. With us to break down what this new database is all about is Nick Penza-Stadler, reporter for the Post Crescent Media in Appleton. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what will we find if we go to this database?
Yeah, it's at postcrescent.com and all the other Gannett sites. And what we did was find as many cases as we could find, track down in a lot of different sources, and we posted them chronologically with some basic information about each one. So they range back from 1926 all the way to one from earlier this year.
And the important thing to note is this didn't exist until just now. There wasn't something like this in Wisconsin.
Right, and another important thing to remember is this isn't all of the cases. This is as many as we can find, and it's a good crack at it, and we have kind of a rolling list, and we have a way to submit cases if agencies or even family members know about a case that we missed. We'd like to add it in.
So what are you hoping comes out of this? Is this something that could actually help solve cold cases?
Absolutely. I mean, we've heard from police all over the state say that these cases need attention, and it's hard, and it's a battle to keep focus on them and keep attention to them, and to get tips continuing to roll in. So this hopefully will shine some light on cases that haven't been talked about or even considered in years, and we're hoping to kick up some new tips and even solve some of them.
We've done one piece on this cold case series that you're working on. Talk about what this means to the people involved, the families in particular, the victims.
Yeah, we've had great response from the families. They're very eager to help because they want justice just like everybody else does. They want these murderers. I mean, there are murderers out there that have not been caught, and they're in Wisconsin, and there are a lot of cases that people don't even think about. So it's kind of a public service we're hoping to provide to both give these the attention they deserve, but also kind of hold police and other officials accountable for keeping the throttle down and remaining kind of on the case.
How do you go about putting together all this kind of information? I'm guessing from a whole bunch of different sources.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really helpful that we had obviously a newspaper archive, and that's where a lot of this came from, and a team of reporters all over the state helped combine and compile a lot of this kind of basic information. Some departments do a really good job, like Racine and Milwaukee, of shining a light on a few of their cases. And then we also filed records requests with the National Incident-Based Reporting System that handles uncleared homicides all over the country.
But we have a picture of some of the victims on our Central Time Facebook page. Puts a face behind the story, the database that we're talking about. Looking at those pictures, I mean, is that a motivator for you, Nick, in working on this?
Absolutely. I mean, especially when you see young children and there's abductions, and a lot of these are heartbreaking cases, very violent cases. And when you see all of the cases together, it's striking to see how many there are. I think we often forget, and you hear about individual murders or cold cases or individual homicides in the state, but you don't think about it as a collective block. And this really stands out as that representation.
As you're pulling this together, all this information about these unsolved cases, are there any trends or common themes that you noticed?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the trends reflect national trends, and that's what our story out this weekend talks about. A lot of the ones that don't get solved end up being strangers. That's just because there is literally no trace left behind. There's a lot less motive. These tend to be done by firearm because there's no physical evidence left behind. In many cases, there's no striking. There's no DNA that can be found. So there are a lot of combined factors that lead to a case going cold that makes it very difficult for investigators to crack.
Is there something that the public, our listeners for that matter, can contribute to the database?
Oh, absolutely. As you'll see, a lot of these don't have photos where either the police didn't have a photo or it didn't get into the system. So we are hearing from family members that have photos, and they want us to promote their loved one's case. So if people do have photos or they have updates or information or even another full case that they want us to verify to see if it's still open, we'd love to hear from them.
Now, what's coming up in this ongoing series on cold cases that you're part of?
We talked about the one for the weekend. That really is talking about clearance rate and how the state is doing, and we actually do a pretty good job at clearing our cases. We looked at a 10-year chunk of about 1,500 murders, and of those, about 300 are still open, and we looked at why they're open and what's being done to keep them rolling. We're also publishing a report soon about police missteps and what can go wrong in an investigation, and also what outside agencies do outside of investigators and families. We're talking about Crime Stoppers and tip systems that can help kick up tips and provide an avenue for tipsters and people with information to get that to the right people.
Well, we'll be watching for that, and we'll be continuing to cover this. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Nick Penzestadler. He's a reporter for Post Crescent Media in Appleton.
On Monday, we'll talk to another Gannett reporter about some of the common mistakes police departments make in these cold cases. That's coming up Monday at 4:30. And now we're going to hear about another challenge facing the criminal justice system. Blood samples being tested for drugs and alcohol are backed up with delays for as long as a year in Wisconsin.
Our reporter Rich Kramer has been working on this story, and he joins us now. Rich, hi.
Hey, good afternoon.
Well, how bad has the backlog been?
Well, it was for certain drugs, especially opiates, it was taking up to more than a year. Just this week, there was a story at a local TV station about a case in Chippewa County that they've been waiting 2 years for the test results to come back. And it was so bad at one point, some coroners at counties were sending their samples to Minnesota, to Hennepin County Medical Center, to have them processed at their own expense.
Let's flesh this out a little. So this might be somebody gets pulled over suspected of drunk driving, or maybe somebody's being tested for drugs for a parole violation, I don't know, and prosecutors need to know what was in their bloodstream, and they're waiting months, even more than a year?
Yeah, basically, most of it has to do with OWI. In 2003, the legislature passed a law saying that you can't have any traces of any drugs, banned substances, in your body, as well as alcohol, when you're driving. So they would take your blood, send it to the lab of hygiene in Madison. They would process it and then get the results back, and that would help them convict the person of the operating while under the influence. But the backlog came when that new law happened. The caseload exploded at the state lab, and for 10 years they didn't really get any extra help or funding.
So they were used to testing, I guess, the alcohol cases that were coming in. Now all of a sudden they're supposed to test for a lot of other drugs. They didn't have the staff to handle that.
Right, and they also do so many other things. I mean, they test for if there's an outbreak of a disease like the swine flu epidemic. Well, I was calling them all the time for that. So they've got their hands full, and now they're just starting to turn the corner on this aspect, on the OWI blood tests.
And how are they doing that? How are they improving things?
Well, three main things. First of all, they got a grant for $400,000 from the Office of Justice Assistance, and with that they were able to outsource about 600 tests. So that alleviated a big problem for them. Not only do they have to test it, but they also have to testify in court if asked. So this they sent the samples to a lab in Pennsylvania that agreed to do it. The other thing, they got funding in this budget. They've got two additional staff that they're going to be adding. I believe there's two more in the next the second year of the biennium. But the biggest thing, what I was told, that helped out with the backlog is they changed their policy. Before, they would test for anything and everything. So if a person had a DWI or an OWI and they tested positive for marijuana and they also found traces of cocaine or whatever else, they would have to run multiple tests to confirm each one of those drugs. Now the policy change is that once they find one drug, they're done testing once they confirm that, because whether you have one drug in your system or, 10, it's still an OWI. You still get, the fine. So that has really helped them out. They said they were able to delete thousands of tests.
Well, now, what impact has this had on law enforcement, this backlog? How much has it slowed down the wheels of justice,
well,
if you will?
The wheels of justice, they grind on, but it was, for cases that went to trial, it was a real headache for district attorneys because they would just be delayed. I mean, they couldn't prosecute until they got those samples back. Unless someone, did a plea deal or whatever. So that was a real headache for them. And especially for really pressing cases that they really wanted to prosecute quickly, that's when they would turn to other sources, like sending the labs or the samples to Minnesota.
Rich, thanks a lot for your coverage, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's WPR's Rich Kramer. You can follow his reporting at WPR.org/news. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. There are currently 20 women in the U.S. Senate. Wisconsin elected Tammy Baldwin to the Senate in 2012, making her the first female senator from Wisconsin.
Baldwin spent this morning delivering remarks on the Senate floor about student loan legislation. Well, according to our next guest, Baldwin is just one of those women who believe they can do what men can't in the Senate, actually get stuff done.
Jill Lawrence is national correspondent at the National Journal. Her piece, Do Women Make Better Senators Than Men, is linked at the Central Time Facebook page. And Jill, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, the Senate has had this reputation as being a bit of a boys' club. How are the new women in the Senate taking on this representation?
Well, I mean, they've got enough to have a club of their own at this point. There's 20 of them, and they get together quite a lot. They don't do it in the gym the way the male senators do. But in a way, you know, it's better for them. They bond. They meet people who don't have the same politics as them because they have such a small group. They can just invite everyone, whether it's, you know, a Tea Party Republican from New Hampshire or Nebraska or the two women from Northern California, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein. So it's, you know, it's a mixed group, and they are making their presence felt in a lot of ways.
So 20 is still not a lot. That's, what, one-fifth?
It's true. I mean, it's a record. It's more than they've ever had. So they're making progress. And in a way, it's a little bit, you know, deceptive because 16 of them are Democrats, and Democrats control the Senate. So there are a lot of women who chair committees these days, and even more who chair subcommittees. You've got women heading up committees like intelligence and budget and appropriations, environment and public works. It's really impressive.
Well, can you talk a little bit about the political makeup of these women? How does it break down?
Well, you have four Republicans. They're the easy ones to analyze. There's two who were elected with Tea Party support, and that would be Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire and Deb Fischer of Nebraska. And then you have two moderates, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who is a pretty interesting case because, as your listeners may recall, she lost a primary to a Tea Party candidate and kind of lost her support from the Republican leadership in the Senate. But she ran as a write-in candidate, and she won. So she did pretty well. Now, in terms of the Democratic senators, there are women from, there's like Claire McCaskill from Missouri, who's from a very red-leaning state, and she's a moderate. And then, as I mentioned, you have the two California senators. So there's a real spectrum. And then you have kind of the pragmatists like Barbara Mikulski, who's the dean of the delegation from Baltimore. And she's been there the longest. She was elected in 1986, and she's the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. So she's giving out the bucks.
Now, why do you think it is that women could be uniquely qualified to get things done in the Senate? What do they bring?
Well, you know, what they say they bring and what they actually bring turn out to be two different things. I mean, if you ask them about, you know, what they can bring, they'll always, almost to a person, talk about how they think they have better consensus-building skills and they, you know, are more pragmatic and they know how to get things done and talk to people so that they can get agreement on things. And it's really, historians will tell you it's too soon to know anything like that. There just aren't enough of them. They haven't been there longer. And also, you know, if you look at the men, some of them do that pretty well, too, as we saw with the immigration bill just recently. So what they really turn out to bring is the personal experience things that affect them that men might not think is that important or may not even give a thought to. For instance, sexual assault in the military is something that women have taken on as a gigantic cause now. And then your own senator talked about discussing with a young woman whether she wanted to run for the state house because she had two young children, and her advice was, you should do it, because if you don't do it, then the policy will be made by people who don't care for young children. So, you know, get in there, get your voice heard, get your issues out there.
What you're talking about, you know, is fantastic, and it's important, obviously, to have those voices there bringing up these issues. But on the other hand, are we kind of ghettoizing women if what they're dealing with and what they're bringing is women's issues, if they're not players in all the whole spectrum of what Congress looks at?
Oh, well, you know, it's interesting. They actually are players on the whole spectrum, and this kind of women's issues ghetto that you call it is part of what they do, but it's not all of what they do. And the other thing that's pretty interesting is that men have started introducing bills and putting those issues on their agenda as well. We're talking about health, education, abortion, you know, issues that women have traditionally been associated with. So some of them actually said they were a little bit fearful of becoming stereotyped. But those were mostly the older women. The younger women don't seem to have that fear, and they just bring up these issues, and they do whatever they want. You know, they've got a whole range of things they care about, and these issues are one of them.
Well, now, speaking of stereotypes, the stereotype of women, which may or may not be borne out in psychological studies, I'm not going to quote any, I don't know for sure, but the stereotype is that women are better at relating to people, better at talking to one another. And so if you were to extrapolate from that, then you could say, well, maybe women could claim that they're going to be better at building bipartisanship. I don't know. Is there anything to that?
Well, you know, again, I think it's hard to say because there's only four Republicans within the women's club, if you want to call it that. And you do have at least as many men who are interested in crossing the aisle. I mean, you had eight people involved in the immigration bill. You had six people, I think they were all different people, actually involved in the Gang of Six trying to figure out a fiscal compromise last year or the year before. So you have men who are certainly interested in talking to each other. And people who have analyzed the Senate, they say that really what women have brought with their diversity is a whole plate of issues, and that's where you see their impact on issues like, you know, including women in clinical trials so that they can get effective new medications. This wasn't done until women made an issue of it back in the 90s.
Now, you don't get into the Senate by being a wallflower, obviously, but you mentioned the women, the 20 of them get together and they have a bit of a women's club in the Senate, and the men in the Senate get together in the gym, it sounded like. But
yeah.
I guess I'm wondering, are the women comfortable talking to the men and being right in there fighting alongside them?
I think they are. I mean, they have a lot of them go on trips, you know, with male senators either overseas or sometimes they visit each other's districts and states to find out firsthand, you know, what is driving that person, what their constituents need. And that's very helpful. There's a lot of interaction on a lot of different levels. So they do find it easy to talk to each other, but I think that they all have pretty close colleagues. You even find people like Barbara Boxer, who is extremely well known as liberal on abortion and environment and climate change, that sort of thing. But she's visited David Vitter's district in Louisiana to see, you know, what's going on with his constituents and the Army Corps of Engineers and the water issues they work on. And, you know, I was pretty skeptical about how good or bad her relationship was with the two men that she'd worked on, the two conservatives she'd worked with most closely on her committee. She's the chairman of the Environment and Public Works Committee. But, you know, their offices, even, you know, in off the record, on background, they said she was great to work with. So, you know, as she says, you find the sweet spot and you work on it.
Now, committee work is often pretty highly sought after, especially chairing some of these committees. Are the women getting in there and getting their piece of that action?
Oh, they sure are. It's been really interesting to watch. Particularly, I guess one person I haven't mentioned yet is Debbie Stabenow of Michigan, who chairs the Agriculture Committee. And she's had a situation where last year and this year she's had two different senior Republican members to work with. And both years they've put together a comprehensive farm bill and done a very nice job of it. And both times it's been kind of sabotaged by the House. In last year, the House never took it up. This year, the House first defeated it, and then they passed one that didn't have a food stamp program in it. So, you know, she's kind of, in the face of a lot of odds, been able to make things work very well, and that's a very important committee. And then you have Patty Murray, who chairs the Budget Committee, who has been the first chairman in 3 years to get a budget out, even with only one party. She managed to reunite the Democrats for the first time in 3 years and get one out. And then you have Dianne Feinstein, who is one of the premier spokespeople in the country for national security. And
we'll hear more about her in just a moment, Jill, as we're talking with Jill Lawrence with the National Journal. Her piece that we're talking about is called Do Women Make Better Senators?
We want to hear what you think about this. Call 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more women in the Senate, in politics in general? Do you think they face unique obstacles? And do they bring a unique perspective? 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Jill Lawrence with the National Journal, talking about her piece, Do Women Make Better Senators Right Now?
And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think women make better senators or politicians at any level? Or is it all the same to you? Would you like to see more women in the Senate, in the House, in the state legislature, in governor's offices around the country? What obstacles do you think they face, and what perspectives do they bring, if any, that are different than their male counterparts? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, 800-642-1234, or send us an email, talk@WPR.org.
Jill, before we left, you were talking about Dianne Feinstein. Do you want to finish up with that?
Well, it's just very striking that what a prominent position she's in on national security policy, and as a spokesperson, she's been on Sunday TV, I think, more than any other woman in the Senate, which is not saying all that much. They haven't been on very much, but she does appear, and she's very much a defender of the national security establishment in this country. So it's an interesting position for a woman to be in, and not at all stereotypical.
Do you get the sense that women in the Senate face more scrutiny than their male counterparts?
Well, some of them talk about the scrutiny they face in terms of their appearances.
Yeah, I was going to say their hair, they certainly talk more about, right?
Right. Susan Collins talks about a reporter, she still remembers this from long ago, a reporter writing that she teetered across the stage in her high heels. And Barbara Mikulski says there's a saying in her office that hair is as important as content when you're giving a speech. So they do have to toe the line on this stuff. You know, they do expect a certain amount of discussion of their appearance.
So it's something they've made peace with?
I think so. I mean, it's just one of those things that becomes less important as you get elected senator.
Now, we talked a bit about how there's still only 20 women in the Senate right now, which is in no way an accurate representation of what America looks like, of course. So why do you think it is still hard for women to get voted into the Senate?
Well, the first thing to say is that there's very few vacancies. Incumbents tend to stay for long years. I mean, the average age of the Senate is old, and people stay for decades. So, and then when seats open up, there's a scramble, and women, you know, typically the candidates for Senate will come from the House, or it'll be a governor, or maybe somebody who's at a very top level in business. And women just haven't infiltrated that kind of community, you know, in the numbers that you would have a big choice of female candidates for the Senate. So it's always a scramble. The parties are always trying to recruit women. You know, for instance, right now, Alison Schwartz in the House from Pennsylvania, she's running for governor. So she's not going to be a candidate to move up to the Senate. You know, there's not enough women to go around, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, do you think women run for Senate and political office in general, or is this something that, you know, we need to encourage women to get into? Is it something holding them back?
Well, there is that. I mean, it's been hard for them to raise money historically, but Emily's List and some of the and the Republican Party are now kind of putting a focus on that. And so that's, you know, if there's a good candidate, there'll be the money there to help her. But the recruitment needs to begin way down at the state legislative level and even at city council level. I mean, Debbie Stabenow came up from county commissioner in Lansing. So, you know, these are the places where it has to start. And I think the more women there are in these positions, the more people will think, maybe I should think about doing that myself. So it's a gradual process. It's moving in the right direction, but it's been extremely gradual.
Let's take a call now. We have Jackie in Menominee. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Great. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I would just like to weigh in, and I think in some respects it's kind of sad that it would be a male or female thing as far as the political leaders of our country. I think that women have a great deal to offer. I think that they have been an unrepresented voice for a long period of time. But I personally would rather see more fairness and their understanding of who they represent and not whether it's male, female, or Republican or Democrat.
That's an interesting take, Jackie. So even with 20, as a woman yourself, with 20 women in the Senate, you want to focus somewhere else.
I don't know if it's well focused in the respect that whomever's in there needs to focus on the people versus, and I don't think that's a gift that just comes to females, although, like I said, I think they have a lot of skills and abilities that are unrepresented, I guess I should say, in our country, the voice. And I think that I would hate to see more females come to the forefront because of the issues that obviously are more female related that seems to be on the burner at this point in time that do not seem to be fair policies.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your perspective, Jackie. Appreciate you calling in. And Jill, do you think a lot of people think the way Jackie does?
Well, I think that one of the things that's going on is that having even just 20 women there is making men think more about issues that affect their wives and daughters and mothers and sisters. So you do have what you might call fairness, you know, and consideration of some of these issues that have to do with, say, caregiving to children and to the elderly, to education. Some of the issues that men have overlooked in the past are now on their front burner, starting with the president, who's talked a lot about pre-K. So there is that effect, and the issues are becoming less women's issues and more issues that everyone discusses. I do think it took some women coming in there in the first place to bring them to the fore, and you know, we may find that women are going to want more representation to make certain things happen that men don't feel are as important. But for now, I think I understand what your caller is saying, and you know, you certainly don't want women in there just because they're women.
Well, I suppose another perspective is we're saying, you know, there's 20 women in there and that's a fifth of the Senate, but this is a record number of women senators right now.
Right. So there is progress.
Are you hopeful that we as a country will get to the point where the gender balance reflects what America looks like?
You know, in countries where they have quotas, they're there. And we don't have that, so we're doing it the organic way. And I think that as more women get into office and become more visible and more groups are focused on helping women at lower levels and move up the political ladder and with the resources they need to do that, that it will continue to increase. The other thing I think is that many of these women are doing very good jobs and are reflecting well on their gender, if you want to put it that way, if anyone's judging it that way. So I think voters are going to be inclined to support them, and there's very little prejudice, it seems, when people are voting. The researchers have found it really depends a lot more on party than on what sex you are.
Well, Jill, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fun.
Jill Lawrence is a correspondent at the National Journal, and her piece, Do Women Make Better Senators, is linked at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll talk to a Wisconsinite who explores the world of French cheese. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Now, there's maybe only one other place on Earth that's as proud of its cheese tradition as we are in America's Dairyland.
And that place is France. Kathy Lyson, one of Wisconsin's own, traveled throughout Europe's Dairyland documenting the different types of cheese and how they're made. And she's recently published a travelogue describing what she found.
Kathy Lyson is with us now. She's the author of The Whole Fromage. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You are a Wisconsinite. Is that where your passion for cheese comes from?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not just a Wisconsinite. I'm actually from Green Bay. So, you know, cheese is sort of in our genes when you're from Green Bay. If you parade around wearing a cheese head, I think you qualify as, some type of cheese expert on some level.
Now, have you always considered yourself a cheese expert, or did you have to grow into it?
Yeah, you know, I use that term. I actually don't even now consider myself a cheese expert. I'm an amateur of cheese, and I use that term in the French sense of the word, which is meaning someone who follows a subject out of love. So I sort of leave the cheese experting to people actually make cheese and make that their career. But I'm definitely very into cheese and always have been.
How would you compare our cheese here in Wisconsin? Answer carefully.
Right.
To the cheese of France.
Well, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Wisconsin, there really wasn't a ton of cheese in Wisconsin other than industrial cheese. And I say that gingerly because I'm sure it existed. I didn't know it as a kid. I grew up with a single mom, and we lived in a trailer, and I sort of ate Kraft macaroni and cheese, and that was my idea of really good cheese. And I know that that has changed a lot in the last decades. I know that there's tons and tons of really good artisan Wisconsin cheese now, and I apologize, all of my research was in France, so I don't know a lot about it. I know it's definitely there, and part of why I wanted to write the book was because a lot of those cheeses are in fact based on French originals. And so, in getting to know more about French cheese, you're also, in fact, getting to know more about the new artisan cheeses that we're making here, especially in Wisconsin, I think.
Well, can you tell us about a few of those cheeses that were inspired by French cheeses that are now being made stateside?
Yeah, there's one called Tarentaise that is based off of cheese called Beaufort from the French Alps. And the name Tarentaise comes from Tarentaise cows, which are one of the breeds that are used to make that cheese in France. And I thought that was really interesting, and you don't necessarily see a lot of info about that when you read about Tarentaise cheese, but that's where it comes from. There is another one made by Windermere Farms that's based off a cheese called Mont d'Or, which is this wonderful cheese that they make in the Jura region of France, only in the winter months, and it's sort of considered a Christmas cheese. And in fact, I did eat one for Christmas during the year in which I was researching the book. So you break into the rind from the top with a spoon. Typically, it makes a great fondue cheese. So there's all kinds of examples like that. If you look at the cheeses that we're now making here in the States,
some of the most fun parts of your book are as much about the people making the cheese and the cheese lovers of France. Give us an example of one of those striking personalities you met along your tour of the cheeses of France.
Yeah, one of the most striking personalities, I really enjoyed meeting, there's a man named René Miremont, and he is a shepherd in the Pyrenees. And a lot of modern cheesemakers are just that. They're very modern, which is great, and they're using really modern methods. That was kind of one of the more surprising things about the book, and one of the reasons why I wanted to investigate and write about it, because you see pictures of cheesemakers, and some of them look sort of the way you would expect a crusty old shepherd to look in France making cheese, and some of them are in these very modern facilities. And that is the way a lot of them are. But René is one of those sort of crusty old shepherd types. And I really enjoyed getting to meet him and talk with him. He goes up into the mountains, or at least he did. He was getting to the point where he was feeling like he couldn't do it anymore. But he used to go up into the mountains every summer into the Pyrenees, and he would stay up there for 3 months at a time with his herd of sheep and just be up there making cheeses all summer long.
Wow. Well, as I understand it, one of the very cool stories of cheese, French cheese, is Camembert, which is one we know pretty well here in the United States. Brie and Camembert we're pretty conversant in, but there's some cheese espionage and stuff that goes, some intrigue that goes along with Camembert, isn't there?
Yeah, at least there was within the history of Camembert. So Camembert There's all kinds of controversy surrounding Camembert, and it's there's a Frenchman who wrote this sort of definitive kind of scholarly book about Camembert, and I've always thought it interesting that it's titled Camembert, a National Myth. So there's all kinds of stories about Camembert, but one of them has to do with the espionage. And so the cheese was supposedly invented by this woman named Marie Harrell in Normandy. And she kept the recipe secret for many years and sort of passed it on to her daughter, who passed it on to her daughters, and it became this family thing. And, of course, there were other makers that were also making versions. But each of them guarded this secret very closely. And so, there's stories about cheesemakers, male cheesemakers, trying to seduce female cheesemakers. The makers of Camembert were typically women, sort of getting them in the barn and trying to use their wiles to get their cheesemaking tips out of them.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's not the only controversy you came across in Normandy. Actually, you mentioned Normandy. It makes me remember. Now, here in Wisconsin, we've got a hot debate about raw milk. There's something going on there in Normandy, too?
Yeah, absolutely. I think raw milk is it's pretty controversial everywhere within the cheesemaking world. You have lots of raw milk devotees who swear by raw milk, and I myself have eaten a lot of raw milk cheese and have never had a problem with it. It did spark something that came to be known as the Camembert War a few years back in Normandy. And what happened was two of the largest makers of Camembert, raw milk Camembert, decided to stop making their cheeses with raw milk and start making it with pasteurized milk, which was bad in and of itself. But then they took that a step further and asked the French government to change the labels. They, on their raw milk Camembert, they had AOC labels, because the AOC, and that's the name control system they have in France that guarantees that food products are sort of authentic. That required the use of raw milk. And so these two makers then not only stopped making their cheeses with raw milk, but asked the French government if it was okay if they could keep the AOC label on their cheeses with the pasteurized milk. They're basically asking them to change the rules. And that is what sparked the Camembert War. And then there was a Camembert True Defense Committee that was formed, and petitions were circulated, and there were documentaries on French television. So that was kind of a big deal a few years back. The French government ultimately denied the request, so Camembert is still made with raw milk. Authentic Normandy Camembert is still made with raw milk. They feel pretty strongly about that.
And then some of the stuff we can't get here, right? We can't import some of these, at least unpasteurized French cheeses, to the U.S., legally, anyway?
Yeah, legally, right. People like to smuggle them in, and I confess on occasion I've done that myself. But they need to be aged for more than 60 days. That's the age at which the U.S. government judges that pathogens have died off. We can't get – it's a real shame that we can't get a lot of those cheeses here in the U.S.
Now, speaking of lots of cheeses, there's this awesome quote. I think it's attributed to Charles de Gaulle. He says something like, how can you govern in a country where there are 246 kinds of cheese?
Right.
So that's pretty staggering. Even from a Wisconsin girl like me, that's a lot of cheese. And some people say that number might be kind of low. It sounds like. Can you tell us about some of the unique discoveries you found that really kind of captured your taste buds?
Yeah, I would say the cheese that I'm still really, I began enamored by it and I'm still really enamored by it is Beaufort, which is made in the French Alps. And it's one of the first cheeses I ended up researching. A girlfriend of mine and I were in France, and she appears in the book, in fact. And we were just sort of, it was really early on, we were just sort of driving around looking for cheesemakers, and we had this cheese map, and it had this little place up in the mountains listed on it, and there were very sketchy directions to it and no phone number. But we took the map and drove up there and ended up witnessing this really amazing cheese making. They make the cheeses up in the mountains in these big copper kettles. And now most of it's made at much lower elevations in cooperatives, and it's sort of a kind of quasi-factory setting. But this was an authentic sort of cheese shack up in the mountains with one guy with his copper kettle. And he, in order to make the cheese, they take a big piece of linen and they swoop it underneath the curds and sort of pull it up all in one swoop. Beaufort is this really big cheese. It's in the book I say it's the size of a small St. Bernard. It's like 100 pounds. So he and it's just this one guy. He gets all these curds up, and then he's got kind of a pulley that's attached to a beam on the ceiling, and he swings it over into the mold. And we got to watch him doing that, which was really amazing.
Is there kind of a conflict between those one-man shops and the crusty old shepherd you mentioned on the one hand, the traditionalists, and then the like higher tech, I guess, factory French cheese?
Yeah, yes and no. I think it's more, it's a distinction that the consumers make more so than the actual cheesemakers. That's sort of the way things are going. There's definitely holdouts who are still trying to do things in a very, very traditional way. It's difficult. Traditional cheesemaking is very labor-intensive, and, of course, that's hard these days. People don't necessarily want a job that, you know, gets them up at 4 o'clock every single morning, that you know, goes 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So I think that the cheesemakers, for the most part, understand that the cheesemaking needs to be modernized if it's going to survive. And a lot of what's happening now is trying to find that balance between having just the right amount of technology that that you can do the job, but still retain what makes the cheese traditional. So it's still got the same format. For example, you're still using, in a lot of cases, they're still using raw milk, trying to retain all the unique aspects of the cheese, but yet get it done.
Now in Wisconsin, we are obviously, as you know, we are cheese savvy people here in Wisconsin.
Yes.
Do you think, though, that we embrace the full vista of cheese varieties and flavors that the French do? You know, the French have these stinky, you know, it's a stereotype that's the stinky French cheese with the mold in it. I mean, do you think that our palates have expanded sufficiently, you know, to embrace, you know, what the French do over there?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. That was part two why I wanted to write the book, is I didn't really become aware of the amazing variety of French cheese until I was in my early 30s. I studied in France when I was younger and somehow managed to sort of miss it and went and bought this guidebook. It was actually a mostly picture guidebook and went, oh my gosh, look at all this cheese. And that was part of what started me off. So I was intimidated by all the weird molds and, you know, there's like a lot of goat cheeses are covered in ash and that looks odd. And now it seems really normal to me. And I think it's starting to seem pretty more normal than it was years ago, at least when I was a kid, to most Americans. But I do think people still sometimes can be intimidated by that, and that's too bad because there's really nothing intimidating about cheese.
What is the most out there, pungent, crazy French-flavored cheese that you ate?
I had one. The most pungent ones are definitely ones that are rind-washed, which is they brush the surface of the cheese while it's aging with some type of liquid. So usually it's kind of a briny bacterial stew. Sometimes there's some alcohol in there. And those are the ones that take on kind of an orangish hue, and the surface is sticky. And those are the ones that stink. They are stinky. I had one that was like that in Corsica, and I won't say what kind it was because I don't want to embarrass the poor Corsicans should they ever, you know, hear of this. But it smelled like feet, and it kind of tasted like feet. It was not my favorite.
And even you didn't like that one.
Yeah. There are, I mean, I don't mean to put down rind-washed cheeses. There are many amazing rind-washed cheeses, and they tend to not taste anywhere near as bad as they smell. They tend to taste really good. They taste kind of like steak often.
Okay, Kathy, in 5 seconds, we have to try one French cheese. Which one do we try?
Oh, gosh. I would say you should try a rind-washed cheese if you've never had one. I would try Epoisse, which is pretty easily available here in the U.S.
Epoisse. All right. Well, Kathy, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Kathy Lyson will be doing a reading and signing copies of her book, The Whole Fromage, on Sunday, August 4th at 3 p.m. at Kavarna in Green Bay. She's the author of The Whole Fromage.
Head on over to the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know your favorite cheese, French or otherwise. Coming up next, we'll talk to a neuroscientist about why our brains love music. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.